From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain and Moment magazine contributor Dan Raviv. Welcome, Cindy and Dan.
Thank you.
Great to be with you, Kim.
Here are the issues. Ukraine says its forces have retaken 37 square kilometers of territory in eastern and southern Ukraine during the past week as part of its counteroffensive against Russia launched in June. Russia and Ukraine accuse each other of plotting to stage an attack on the Zaporizhia nuclear power station, which has long been the subject of mutual recriminations and suspicions. NATO allies are preparing for their annual two-day summit July 11th and 12th in Lithuania, as Ukraine urges the alliance to fast-track its proposed membership. Israel withdrew troops from a West Bank militant stronghold Wednesday, but warned that its most intense military operation in the occupied territory in nearly two decades could be repeated. Almost a week of rioting across France was sparked by the shooting of a teenager of North African descent during a police traffic stop in a Paris suburb. 16 mass shootings occurred across the U.S. as the nation marked its celebratory 4th of July long weekend. At least 15 people were killed and 94 injured. President Biden repeated his call for gun control reforms, including a renewed ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and an end to gun manufacturers' immunity from liability. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Cindy, you've been reporting on Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia. Also, you report that analysts say the recent mutiny against Russia's top commanders may have an impact on the morale of Russian soldiers on the battlefield. So can you tell us more about this?
We are hearing now that the Wagner Group, this mercenary group, which had been, you know, fighting in Ukraine, and the leader of that, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who had launched this armed rebellion and basically had a column of forces marching on Moscow. We had heard that there was some kind of settlement mediated by the leader of Belarus, Lukashenko, and that he was in Belarus. And now Lukashenko is saying, no, Prigozhin is actually not in Belarus anymore. He's in St. Petersburg, which this whole thing shows, you know, we don't know exactly about his whereabouts, but it shows that basically this agreement to stop this armed rebellion against the Russian Defense Forces is nothing more than a ceasefire and an uneasy ceasefire at that. And analysts are telling me that this shows that you have armed resistance, basically a challenge to Russian President Putin and to the Russian state. And the resistance and the response to defend Putin and his forces was tepid at best. You know, there wasn't much response. People were coming out and celebrating and bringing food and warm drinks or whatever to the Wagner Group fighters. One analyst described it as a ticking time bomb for Putin, saying, look, these mercenaries killed Russian soldiers. And Putin goes on national TV and calls them traitors, but then basically backs down and they're not being punished. You know, they're not being hunted down. So this does send a message with analysts saying, look, if I were a Russian soldier, I'd be asking, how does somebody who killed Russian soldiers get away with it?
Now, Cindy, we don't know exactly how much information Russian troops can get. One thing that's clear about Vladimir Putin as president of that country is that he has managed to control the media. And it is true, of course, that a lot of Russian journalists have left their country and have set up shop in other countries, you know, typically in Eastern Europe, and they're doing their best to report the kind of news that people can believe, you know, that VOA News is also trying to do that job. But frankly, it's very difficult to find out what's happening inside when Putin has so much control. So I see the possibility that he is spinning all these events, even what the Wagner Group did, to his own advantage. I also have to admit that I was, well, either hoping or expecting that Ukrainian forces would take advantage of that mutiny just a few weekends ago and be able to push really hard against Russian forces on Ukrainian territory, because I thought the Russians would be very demoralized. And though Ukraine reports that it's making some slow progress in its big counteroffensive, I really wonder whether the Russian troops have been so demoralized. I don't know what you're hearing about that.
Right. And I see your point, Dan. And analysts are telling me, you know, obviously it's not something that we didn't see an overnight altering of the course of the war or anything like that. It's more like a slow erosion. And the CIA director, William Burns, also said that I think most people probably did catch wind of, you know, a column of forces and tanks moving towards Moscow and basically taking over the one southern city. So it registered, I think, for most people. If now we're hearing that Prigozhin, he's not even in exile, so to speak, but he's back in Russia. This exposes Putin as not being the all-powerful, all-beloved Russian leader that he claimed to be.
Yeah, very good points that you both have brought up. And in another aspect to this, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russian forces have placed devices resembling explosives on the roofs of nuclear reactors of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Russia, in turn, claims Ukraine is planning military action against the nuclear facility. What is international reaction to these claims, and what can be done if there really is a threat to the nuclear facility?
I'm picking up a really high degree of concern. You just say the word nuclear and you couple it with what President Putin of Russia has been threatening almost since the beginning of this war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February of last year. And Putin has suggested that Russia's nuclear weapons might possibly be used, tactical nukes, as some military experts put it. And now we come down to this power plant at Zaporizhia, which the Russians were able to seize. And so clearly there are Russian forces there and they can do what they want to do. And so it's not just imagination that the Russians could stage some sort of event and then some radioactivity could get out and Russia would blame Ukraine. And we're getting a blame game, but at least as the time that we're recording this, nothing terrible has happened there yet. But it's like this dark cloud that everyone's worried about, that something could happen at Zaporizhia.
Yes, it is very, very concerning. And like you say, Dan, just mentioning the word nuclear, it just excites fear in people because you're thinking of what happened with Chernobyl back in the 1980s.
And that was on Ukrainian soil. So international experts, like in the UN agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, have long been wondering what are the standards of the work at Zaporizhia. And now that it's in the middle of a war zone, it's generally been turned off and not making much electricity for Ukraine. But of course, the nuclear core is still there.
Yes, very concerning issue there. And in the meantime, President Biden had hosted Sweden's prime minister at the White House as NATO leaders are preparing for a summit this month in Lithuania. And Sweden is trying to join NATO, and this is a move prompted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And NATO leaders gave their approval to Sweden's accession at their 2022 summit, but Turkey and Hungary have not yet ratified Sweden's bid in a process that must be unanimous among all current members. So what can we expect? Will the U.S. be able to persuade Turkey and Hungary to approve Sweden for NATO?
Well, that's a really good question, Kim. And from what I am hearing now from experts, particularly on Turkey, that the newly reelected Turkish President Erdogan is digging in and is just refusing to end his opposition to Sweden joining. And I think the U.S. was always optimistic that perhaps after the election that he would give in. But now I'm hearing that sort of plan B arrangements are being made because Sweden, having committed itself to NATO and being in such close proximity to Russia, is kind of exposed and is vulnerable to Russian reprisals. And that now U.S. and NATO and others are thinking of other security agreements, which could basically reassure Sweden, we will protect you and we will defend you in the case of any Russian attack. So, you know, this could all change at the drop of a hat, but right now it's not looking good.
Well, it turns out the summit of the NATO alliance in Vilnius, Lithuania, this coming week is really important to Joe Biden and even to the fact that he wants to be reelected as American president next year. He wants to score some successes in international relations. And he's been boasting, of course, about the strength that NATO is showing. against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so now we see cracks in the NATO alliance with Hungary and Turkey not willing to go along. As you said, Cindy, Turkey's reelected president Erdogan wants to be, you know, a big local hero again. And he does have an issue with Sweden, where there have been anti-Muslim events, in large part anti-immigrant events in Sweden, incidents that Turkey really wants to protest against and put pressure on the Swedes. Also, he wants Sweden not to be supportive of Kurdish separatists. And so that's a big issue for Turkey. So you're quite right. You know, we don't see Turkey easily giving in, but folks may be surprised that all of this is really important to Joe Biden. It's not just, oh, one more country to enter NATO. No, having a really solid Western alliance at this time is considered really important, and also to Biden as a politician.
Yes, that's very true. And also moving over to Israel, where Israel withdrew troops from a West Bank militant stronghold. So, Dan, what is your take on this latest military operation?
Well, there are several factors that came together all at once. There's been an upsurge of violence in the West Bank, the land that was captured by Israel in 1967 and in the famous Six-Day War, as nobody sees a political solution. Nobody sees on the horizon some agreement between Israelis and Palestinians of how to share the land or if there'll be a Palestinian state. And so there's been a lot of frustration. And frankly, since Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, formed a new coalition just over half a year ago that includes the so-called extreme right, meaning government ministers who want to keep the West Bank forever, who says that it's Jewish land and the Israelis won that war in 1967. And Netanyahu seems to be conceding to them because he has to keep his coalition together. And you add to that the attacks, some of them by Palestinian terrorists against Israeli civilians in the West Bank and sometimes in Israel itself, and some attacks by Israeli settlers in the West Bank against innocent Palestinians. And so the Israeli leaders felt that they had to go into this one city, Jenin, in the northern part of the West Bank, that contains a refugee camp, and saying that no one has taken control, that even the Palestinian Authority, which got a lot more authority in the West Bank, has walked away from Jenin. And so it's become, according to the Israelis, a terrorist stronghold. Now, according to many Palestinians, what it is a center of heroic resistance. Well, the Israelis decided not to tolerate that, and so they went in full force, even with airstrikes by drones and helicopters, something that Israel hadn't done in the West Bank in 20 years. And the result, according to the Israelis, is a good counterterrorism mission. But frankly, the Palestinians say that it's another example of them being oppressed and persecuted. So it certainly isn't leading to a solution of the problem, but the Israelis say they had to strike back against terrorists.
What is the U.S. response to this?
Right, Kim. Well, we have not seen much of a response. We've had the U.S. and the State Department condemning the violence and the killings on both sides and urging both sides to stop the spiral of violence. And the U.S. officially still supports what's called the two-state solution of having Israel and a Palestinian state being established and being side by side. But most experts say, at least for now, that two-state solution is dead, and saying that President Biden has so many other issues on his plate, both domestically and with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that he doesn't really want to get bogged down in this age-old conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and that, you know, he does send Secretary Blinken and other diplomats to try to engage. But as Dan pointed out, right now, with Israel's most hardline nationalist government ever and a weak Palestinian leadership, we've just had a prolonged absence of any kind of real peace talks. And President Biden doesn't really seem to be willing to spend the political capital to really crack down on the Israeli government and say, look, we're going to cut our generous military funding for you, or something along those lines, to really use some leverage.
Here are three things to look for when it comes to United States policy in the Middle East. First, I think about Iran and its nuclear program, which, according to the U.S. and also the U.N. agency, Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons. The Biden administration says it will not allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. So I'd like to see what it is that the U.S. does to slow that down. There are reports that the U.S. has been negotiating with Iran through intermediaries to get a pledge not to carry that nuclear program further in exchange for loosening some sanctions and maybe releasing some frozen money that Iran has. The second thing that comes to mind is Saudi Arabia, where the United States is hoping that Saudi Arabia might join the list of Arab countries that have open diplomatic relations with Israel. And lastly, although President Joe Biden obviously disagrees with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel on so many things, it is politically popular in the U.S. to be pro-Israel. And Biden generally is pro-Israel, so he has invited the president of Israel, the less controversial Isaac Herzog, to come to Washington and address a joint session of Congress to mark Israel's 75th birthday this year. So we get this mix here where the U.S. is not comfortable with Netanyahu and his government, but Biden still wants to send out friendly signals toward the state of Israel.
Very interesting. Politics always makes for an interesting mix. Well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, France's president hopes to get to the root cause of what led to the shooting of a teenager of North African descent during a police traffic stop in a Paris suburb. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Moment Magazine contributor Dan Revive. Well, France has been beset by violent unrest in recent days after a police officer shot and killed a teenager in a Paris suburb. Nahel M. was a French citizen of Algerian descent, and widespread riots erupted in the streets of France following Nahel's death, with at least five consecutive nights of violence. So this violence was a very large scale, destroying property, businesses. Why did it get to this level?
Well, that's a good question, Kim. And some people are sort of comparing it to the massive Black Lives Matter protests that we've had in the U.S., with saying that this is France's George Floyd moment, referring to George Floyd, who was killed with a famous video of a police officer's knee on his neck in May of 2020, which sparked a summer of widespread protests and unrest and also some violence and burning of property and looting here in the U.S. And analysts are saying that there is racism among French police. It is a problem. And that although most people do not condone burning and looting a village, and some people also being injured, a mayor's wife and children being injured in an attack, they say they understand that this is a venting of pent-up frustrations that some North African immigrants in France do have, to just a feeling that the system, you know, is not fair to them. And we're seeing this now in the widespread protest. And Macron, who's had sort of one wave of protest after the other to deal with, is also trying to get a handle on this.
You wonder what the solutions might be from President Macron's point of view, whether it's to vastly increase the police presence in the various neighborhoods where immigrants generally live, or to look for some changes in society to make these ethnic and racial and religious minorities feel that they are part of the modern Republic of France, that they are needed, that they do valuable work, that they have educational opportunities. That seems to be the direction that Macron would like to go. But what's frustrating is that is not a solution that works within a year or two or before the next French election, but something that really would have to change. And so it is a reality, of course, in many European countries where migration was considered necessary to bring in workers, sometimes to do jobs that, quote, white people, unquote, weren't willing to do. And so it's not only in France, but in other countries. And at a certain point, those immigrant communities, those minorities feel that they haven't been listened to, they haven't been given opportunities. And then on video, there's a police officer who needlessly shoots and kills a minority young man who was, you know, driving a car. It's just outrageous. And so you go from protests in the streets to them becoming violent protests, which obviously don't do any good at all. And frankly, make, if I can put it this way, the white majority in a country like France kind of distrustful, of course, of the ethnic minorities. It's a bad situation. And the Macron government is not going to find any quick solutions.
No, I agree. This is going to have to be a long-term solution with everyone getting to a unanimous agreement. And talking of violence, 16 mass shootings occurred across the U.S. as the nation marked its celebratory 4th of July long weekend. President Biden issued a 4th of July statement from the White House in which he lamented the senseless shootings. And he repeated his call for meaningful gun control reforms, including a renewed ban on assault weapons. However, there's really not too much more that President Biden can do.
Well, there again is a problem with no quick solutions that reflects a cultural change, that there are people in all kinds of communities, and no one listening around the world should misunderstand that it's only racial minorities or only whites or only blacks or whatever. There's been a cultural change in some people or some parts of America that life itself isn't being respected. When people get into some arguments and somebody pulls a gun and fires bullets, you know, it's sometimes it's young people at a block party for July 4th, America's Independence Day, and they open fire and shot a lot of people, or a gun battle at one of those block parties. And then on the other hand, in Philadelphia, there was a person who, using an assault rifle, attacked a party for no discernible reason. Yes, that person has been arrested. But you know what? Once those people come to trial, often a year or two later, they don't even testify. We don't even understand why they did it. It is puzzling and it is upsetting here in the U.S.
Yes, I would agree, Dan, it is. And just the numbers are very bleak, with already 346 mass shootings in 2023 and the U.S. on pace for a record-setting year as a country that already has an epidemic of these mass shootings.
Yes, and as you all brought out earlier, there is no short-term solution, no short fix to this. Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists. Cindy, what is weighing on your mind this week?
Well, Dan mentioned that we just recently celebrated the July 4th holiday, which is a celebration of American independence and a time of national unity. And there are some, you know, like these mass shootings, definitely some worrisome and depressing aspects with the country, cultural issues dividing the country in many ways. But there was a Supreme Court decision that was widely hailed by many people. Basically, the Supreme Court ruled that state legislators do not have sole authority over elections. And this was a bid where state legislatures could basically say, oh, we're just going to send in our own slate of electors or whatever, also for the presidential election. So many people saw this as a, you know, regardless of politics, just as a win for democracy, because we do have a system of checks and balances in the United States, and states cannot use what are discriminatory means in elections. That was something that I thought was good news for the 4th of July holiday.
Thank you. And Dan?
Well, I've been thinking about travel. It's the summer season, and so a lot of people do take their vacations this time of year. And if you haven't heard, airplanes are full. The highways were full around the 4th of July holiday. There just seems to be this post-pandemic desire to get away from home. And if possible, go see family and friends that maybe you haven't seen for 3 years because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There is a strong sense of it being over. And that's really what people wanted. And you just really see it. You see it at the airports. You see it at the gasoline stations, you know, where people have to fuel up before they hit that crowded highway again. I suppose it's a good thing. But frankly, the traffic and the crowds at the airports are also kind of annoying. Isn't it great to be annoyed again?
Okay, well, thank you. And we'll end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Moment Magazine contributor Dan Revive. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for more Issues in the News.